Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. There are rules, then there are rules. This is how some NATO countries approach Ukraine's membership in the alliance. Will the U.S.-led military alliance attempt to invite Kyiv into the club through some kind of back door at the upcoming summit in Vilnius? To discuss this issue and more, I'm joined by my guests, Martin Jay in Marrakesh. He's an award-winning journalist and commentator. And in Budapest, we cross to George Samueli. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with George in Budapest. We have the upcoming NATO summit in Vilnius, and there's a flurry of reports about, you know, what to do for Ukraine, because in 2008, there was a promise that one day will happen. Well, that seems like a distant memory, considering what's happened, particularly over the last 16 months. And we have to always be cautious, is that, well, NATO, by its own rules, does not allow members to join if they have territorial disputes. Well, I think Ukraine is in kind of that category right now, George. But it's something you and I have talked about for a very long time, is that the rules don't mean much to this alliance. They'll break their own rules if it suits their own purposes. George.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Peter. They will break their own rules. The problem that they have is that they are hoist by their own petard. I mean, Zelensky is saying to them, hey, I don't need no stinking NATO membership, you know, in 5 years' time, by which time Ukraine will have been completely defeated by Russia. I need NATO membership now. I need NATO to be fighting on my side now. And NATO doesn't quite know what to do with this argument. So they're coming up with all these some convoluted ideas. Well, maybe we can go to have some bilateral agreements. So maybe France or Poland can guarantee Ukraine. But what's the advantage for France to guarantee the security for Ukraine? That means France will be just on the hook to fight on behalf of Ukraine.
Well, George, we do have the precedent, you know, that the UK and France made security guarantees to Poland in 1939. Yes, exactly. How did it help the Poles?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Going. And now we have Anders Fogh Rasmussen, the former NATO Secretary General, who now serves as a advisor to the Ukraine government. He says, well, maybe we can create something called the Coalition of the Willing. So Poland and the Baltic states, you know, they go in and fight on Ukraine's behalf. And of course, what happens then is that if, you know, since they're fighting in Ukraine, Russia targets Poland and the Baltic states, then they will scream, Article 5, Article 5, we're under attack. NATO, you know, one for all for one, NATO must enter the war. Well, you know, Rasmussen thinks that we're all bloody stupid, that we don't realize what he's proposing. So essentially, they think that they can sneak Ukraine through the back door, that there isn't a formal invitation, but in effect, NATO will still manage to get into this war on Ukraine's behalf.
Well, we have to all remember Rasmussen, the former head of NATO. He has to propose something to get that fat paycheck that he's getting from the Ukraine, which the Americans are subsidizing. Okay, Martin, they're trying to square a circle right here. Again, you know, they have their rules, but if, you know, there was some kind of expeditionary force from Poland, well, that's a NATO country as far as Russia is concerned. I mean, and there's one thing that I think is very important that is almost never, ever mentioned in the discourse is that, you know, we always hear about Article 5, but there is an Article 1 of the NATO treaty. And basically, and I'm just going to use common parlance here, don't start wars, okay? And this is essentially what some are proposing, again, to break their own rules, which, you know, I wouldn't be surprised when they do because they do it all the time. Martin.
Yeah, but what is the price for breaking those rules? I mean, you have something now which is, I would say, completely unprecedented and very much a turning point now in the Ukraine war. What we're seeing now is a group of countries in Eastern Europe who met recently in Bucharest who are all banging their fists on the table and say, we need NATO membership for Ukraine. And let's not talk about it in months or whenever. Let's actually talk about it as a reality that could happen right now, because they see the only way for any development positive on the Western side, for any progress, they see the subject, the taboo subject, let's talk about subjects which are never talked about, the taboo subject of Ukraine's shortage of soldiers. And this is really, in my view, what's central to this whole NATO debate. You know, Zelensky bangs on and on about military equipment, but he would never touch the subject of the numbers of soldiers that he needs. Now, you know, retired US colonels are being interviewed on the internet and who are very well informed because they're getting their information from the ground rather than from the Pentagon. They're saying that Zelensky hasn't lost 100,000 soldiers. They're saying he's lost close to 250,000. They're talking about press gangs rounding up men over the age of 48 years old who've got a three-hour lifespan on the battlefront. So the real issue is men, soldiers on the ground. We saw reports recently in the UK of 50 SAS soldiers already operating in Ukraine. That's quite a high number for special forces to operate behind enemy lines. But I think what we're seeing in NATO now is a double-barreled admission from NATO and from this group of more gung-ho members. One, what NATO has done, what Western elites have done in the last 15 months is nowhere near enough. They really haven't achieved anything, and they've underestimated everything. They've underestimated the amount of money, the number of the amount of kit, and they've underestimated the resolve of Russians. You know, and two, the second point really is that when we talk about military kit and soldiers, you know, the estimation I think is so underestimated that we could be looking at now tripling or quadrupling the actual military support. So these countries are saying, they are talking about the possibility of going into Ukraine, sending their soldiers into Ukraine, but not with a NATO mandate, with a mandate simply from their own governments. And the Russians will just simply accept, hopefully, that this is not NATO, this is not the West fighting.
George, you know, right, these are not NATO troops. Okay?
No, not NATO. No.
This is just, see, this is what's really absurd because, George, I mean, this is the kind of the facade is that, number one, if suddenly, miraculously, NATO accepts, you know, Ukraine into the alliance, that will that deter the Russians? No. Why would it? How in what way? And then this kind of this, you know, wave the magic wand and say that, well, Poland's a part of NATO, but these troops are not part of NATO, but they're Polish citizens. I mean, this is kind of, this is a circle jerk here. Sure.
Two-speed NATO.
Yeah, that's right. And the thing is that they are also convinced that Russia is afraid of NATO. So they think, well, okay, let's, you know, sneak in Poland and the Baltic states and whoever wants to join this coalition of willing. And Russia will say, hey, we don't want to hit Poland, because if we hit Poland, Poland's going to scream Article 5. Then we're at war with NATO, and we are afraid of NATO because NATO is much bigger, much stronger than we are. And, you know, we're not ready to go nuclear. NATO, however, is ready to go nuclear. So that's the argument, that we can essentially bring in additional manpower, and Russia will simply not dare to hit this vampire and will just simply slink away in defeat. That's the argument. But of course, you know, why should Russia accept this? I mean, you know, once you're in and you're fighting on Ukraine's behalf in Ukraine, then Russia will hit you and will extend the war. I mean, you know, what's a fair target? Well, Polish air bases, Polish logistics, supply lines, everything will be a fair game. And, you know, then it'll be up to NATO. What are you prepared George, to do? Are you prepared to escalate?
But using their argument is that, you know, no, this is a bilateral. This is a bilateral. Yes. So Russia can say, well, we're going to bilaterally bomb you. Okay. the argument caves in on itself. Martin, yes. Jump in.
Yeah, because they're making a huge assumption, which is that Putin went to that. And the reason why is because the track record on Putin's side has been very much about de-escalation. He's never risen to the bait. He's always backed down because he knows what the implications are. They're too horrific to even discuss. I mean, I can hardly believe what I'm saying here. Are we actually possibly looking at the early stages of a nuclear war? I mean, this is where this is all heading. You know, when you start talking about, could we even imagine the three of us a few months ago talking about troops on the ground in Ukraine? You know, when I was talking about British and American soldiers and it being inevitably arriving there, I was really talking about low numbers and probably covert. So the SAS being there, I think it makes a lot of sense. And if we did have Polish forces or Lithuanian forces in there, you can bet your bottom dollar that British SAS numbers would rocket, would go right up, because the British are probably being the most gung-ho of all the Western nations, even more than America, in terms of what they're actually doing on the ground and leading. So, you know, we are getting into a very, very dangerous situation of escalation where we assume that Putin will not escalate if we escalate. But I don't think we can bank on that. I think now the narrative is turning now to, you know, there are many American mainstream journalists now who are actually beginning to admit that the Russia is stuck narrative is no longer relevant, if it ever was. You know, and that Ukraine is taking huge losses on the battlefield. And that if we are going to make any difference in Ukraine, you know, we need to do something much, much, much bigger on a much bigger scale. And I think that's really what NATO is negotiating and working out now with its hawks on the eastern side of Europe and its doves in terms of France and Germany, who don't want escalation. They don't want a war, a real war with NATO at all. You know, the language is turning to tactical strikes. That's what I'm hearing a lot about, tactical strikes, which is very, very dangerous. You know, I mean, and where does that take Biden leading up to the elections? You know, how is he going to explain this to voters when the economy in America is going to start to turn? All the experts are pointing this out that, you know, Biden's got quite good data statistics at the moment on inflation. Well, inflation is just one aspect of an economy. There are many, many other factors where, you know, it's looking as though America's clout financially around the world is slowly in a demise, you know, and going to the election, is Biden going to have to stand by these bold, bellicose, grandiose statements that his people made at the beginning? You know, we need to teach the Russians a lesson. We need to hit them so hard that they'll never do this again in Ukraine or other countries. You know, how do you get out of that? How do you unpack that? How do you backpedal out of that? Very, very difficult. So the ratchet that we always talk about on this show is turning, you know, in one direction only. And, you know, as crazy, as nuts as it sounds, you know, we are looking now at tactical strikes. We are looking now at nuclear capability.
It's a choice that NATO's made. George, we've got 45 seconds before we go to the break. But from the Russian perspective, they are at war with NATO. So, I mean, I don't know what NATO, what kind of game they're playing in their head. They're not making, I mean, Leopard tanks, okay. I mean, you know, they're not Ukrainian tanks, okay. I mean, again, this is just kind of a discursive playground that the NATO is playing. 30 seconds before we go to the break.
Exactly. I mean, if deterrence has failed to deter NATO from essentially getting involved in a war against Russia, using Ukraine as a proxy to fight Russia, then by the same token, deterrence will fail to deter Russia in striking NATO. I mean, basically, Russia's going to say, what do we have to lose? NATO is already waging a war against us. You know, basically, all bets are off. Yeah, this is it.
We should never get to the point, what do we have to lose? That is the place we cannot go, okay? Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on NATO. Stay with RT.
Do wieczora antyrosyjskie treści, antyrosyjskie artykuły. Widać, że to zostało zamówione, zakupione.
Opierać się na nienawiści, która to nienawiść łatwo, w tej chwili w Polsce, przeradza się w rasizm, jest rzeczą niewybaczalną, dlatego że z takiej drogi się...
Nie mamy wątpliwości co do tego, że Rosja jest groźna. W związku z tym konsekwentnie wzmacniamy polskie siły zbrojne od 2015 roku.
Польща стремится стать главным союзником США на территории Европы вместо Германии.
Польша поступает в качестве троянского коня американцев и подрывает Евросоюз.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the home edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, let's go back to Martin and Marrakesh. One of the interesting things, the dilemmas, one of the dilemmas that NATO has, it is always very stubbornly and proudly and arrogantly said, you know, we're going to go wherever we want to go. And, you know, the hell with the Russians, okay? Well, they've hit a brick wall, okay? Of course, you know, Sweden and Finland, that's is on the agenda. Of course, they want to get in the poorest country in Europe, Moldova, God knows why, whatever, okay? But they've hit a brick wall with Ukraine. And anyone has been paying attention, this is a critical, pivotal point for Russia, that no, under no circumstances, whatever form Ukraine is, it will not be a member of NATO. NATO's kind of dug itself into a trap right here, because someone is saying no to NATO, and they're not used to it. Martin?
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's very worrying that the narrative has turned to this level now, where we're actually discussing the possibility of any of these countries from Eastern Europe coming in. And, you know, let's look at it from a different perspective. I see it in a quite negative way. I think that, first of all, you know, we're looking at a new NATO now, which is divided. You know, it's like a two-speed NATO, you know, and we've never done that before. Like everything that NATO's done in Ukraine before, you know, you've often said, you know, this is not Libya, this is not Syria, this is the Russians that we're fighting. You know, it's a huge experiment. And I think what's happening now with these meetings, you know, and with NATO leaders and with Zelensky becoming more and more aggressive, you know, I think we're reaching a point of admission that the project hasn't worked and it's been massively underfunded, probably. And when we talk about $120, $130 billion of US money going into the whole Ukraine machine, probably that was nowhere near enough. Probably you'd have to look at three, four, five times that to have the kind of impact that the Ukrainians want, because they're talking about penetrating that line. And, you know, no one has the secret. No one has the so-called spring offensive has become a summer offensive. You know, I don't know how you find two or three, 400,000 soldiers without going
that's just the point. Martin, that's just the point. George, I mean, you're in Hungary. I mean, and you're not a government official, so I'm just going to ask your opinion. But how many Hungarians are going to join up for that project going into Ukraine? I mean, I kind of remember history that, you know, last time your Hungarian troops were in that part of the world, it didn't work out too well for them. George?
Well, that's a very good point, and certainly that's a point that, you know, Viktor Orban emphasizes. Hungary got sucked into World War II. Hungary took part in the invasion of the Soviet Union as an ally of Hitler's and got clobbered after World War II. You had to endure, you know, the 40 years of communism. That's what you do. You know, if you start a war and you lose the war, you get clobbered. I mean, that's an inevitability, and it is something that Orban makes clear. But it is an interesting issue, though, that with what NATO has now done, it's gone all in with Zelensky. They are going to make some kind of a commitment to Zelensky. I mean, I don't think Vilnius is just going to, they're going to
settle. All right, George, are you teasing us? Okay, I'm going to bite. What do you think it is going to be?
Well, I think that it's probably going to be something along the lines of Rasmussen's plan for a coalition of the willing. I mean, if, you know, if people want to go help Ukraine, go right ahead and try and help. You see, the problem is that now that NATO has made it an existential matter for itself, it can't just back away. Because if it backs away, it's essentially admitting we lost.
Yeah. Yep.
We didn't just lose. I mean, we can lose in Afghanistan. Okay, we lost, you know, a bunch of goat herders. You know, that's fine. Okay, we lost to some.
No, if they lose, it's the end of NATO. Let's face
it.
Okay?
We lost to Russia. This is, you know, our bête noire. You know, this is the people that we've been hating for years and years, you know, decades. We lost. Democracies have lost. I mean, you know, the great divide between democracies and autocracies, that's gone. The autocracies have won. NATO can't afford to do that, and therefore NATO just has to escalate. I mean, there's no way to back away, because there isn't anyone in NATO, with the exception of Viktor Orban, who's suggesting, look, this is nuts. NATO just has to sit down, you know, forget all this hot air and just work something pragmatic out with Russia, just as we used to work something pragmatic out with the Soviet Union. But there's no one in NATO prepared to do that. So they're all in, and I don't see any willingness on NATO's part to back down.
Well, are we back to the War of the Roses? I mean, for democracy? I mean, I thought this was all about security, okay? That is the discursive mistake, Martin, the West has made, is to try to equate the two. They have nothing to do with one another. And if you look at Russia's posture, it is all about its security. It is never about politics in that sense, Martin.
Yeah, and I think it's also been, the last couple of weeks, it's been a very dark period for media in covering these events, you know, and I wonder how much media has played, the kind of role it's played in contributing to this pivotal moment that we're witnessing now. You know, this NATO summit is actually going to produce some sort of, in my view, it will offer Zelensky some sort of deal, which will just involve more military hardware, but a lot more. And intelligence sharing and training.
Yeah, but Martin, from what I understand, I mean, again, this is called the fog of war in media, in propaganda. But I mean, the warehouses are empty. Okay, I mean, they're ordering things to be made.
That's a big problem.
Not to ship.
That is a big problem, yeah. And it may well be that there might be a collective call around the world for all of America's friends to look at second and third generation equipment, you know, Russian tanks from the 1980s here in Morocco, for example, that may well be part of it. But I think, you know, what's worrying is that although I am seeing a very, very slight shift from the narrative in America, you know, American journalists are starting to point the finger and ask, you know, slightly acerbic questions. You know, we still have very, very, very little erudite reporting on the ground, which is really not helping. I mean, it's absolutely incredible that Tucker Carlson's first video on Twitter just exploded, absolutely exploded. Why did it explode? I'm not a fan of Tucker Carlson, but why did it explode? Because journalists are not asking those really, really basic questions that this guy is asking. You know, when we talk about the Kakhovka Dam, you know, I mean, why would Russia do that to itself? You know, is there something else there? Did the Ukrainians actually take pot shots at the dam a couple of months earlier? Yes, the Washington Post reported on this. Why is that being airbrushed out of the narrative now, where, you know, every media outlet in Britain and America has just basically pointed the finger at Russia and said, it's a done deal. We're not going to look at anything else. The Russians did it, you know. But what I think is happening is that with the NATO summit, with the dam attack, I think, and James Cleverly's statement a couple of weeks ago that the Ukrainians have every right to hit Russia within Russia, I think what's happening is we are being softened up. We are being prepared for a new wave, a new policy towards the war in Ukraine. And I think
Of course people are going to vote on this, George, right? This is a popular war in the West, right? Or is it elite driven? Explain to us, George.
Well, that's a very good point, because of course at any time when the war implicitly is an issue, the voters vote against it. There is no popular mandate anywhere for this war. And there is a reason why the Alternative für Deutschland party is doing well in Germany. Remember, you know, the Germans are very, very, very wary of voting for any right-wing party. I mean, this party has obviously nothing to do with Nazism or anywhere else, but the moment you say, oh, this is a far-right party, this is a nationalist party, Germans are very wary of this. Nonetheless, essentially.
Isn't it interesting, George, it takes Russia, it was before the Soviet Union, you know, to make people, you know, would it be injected into German politics, and now, you know, it's fighting Russia, and now the right is, you know, they're seeming, you know, these people are going to be our say. It's interesting how it kind of shifts around, but always it's the point, Russia.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, the ones who are the most bellicose about Russia in Germany, you know, in Annalena Baerbock. I mean, it's the left. I mean, it's the Greens are absolutely insane, as are Greens generally throughout Europe. I mean, this is very much a project of the left. I mean, they're the ones who somehow have identified Russia as the enemy, and that there can be no backing down. It's not, they're just not prepared to say, hey, Russia is the enemy, but, you know, we don't want to destroy the world. I mean, they seem to be ready. Yeah, Russia is the enemy, and we're ready to go all the way. We're you know, like Liz Truss. Yes, I'm ready to press the button. Not even, you know, we don't even have to specify what are the conditions under which you're ready. I'm just ready to press the button.
And you have Annalena Baerbock saying Putin has to change his position 360 degrees. That's it. What's the kind of people we're dealing with here? Martin, more seriously, very interesting. You said, you know, there might be a call for American allies with its, 800 bases around the world, you know, to maybe pony up additional equipment. But it sends a very interesting message to the global South, particularly China, is that, oh, you know, they, you know, it's a country like Ukraine that can stop the West, you know, in its heels. I mean, that's a very interesting message if you're going to have to start scrounging around. So the NATO is not what we were told, okay? And it's, first of all, it's divided and it's pretty short on supplies, because I've always said, if Russia was such a danger to NATO countries, why didn't they spend more money on defense? They didn't. Martin.
Because they could have never imagined being in a conflict like that, which would draw out the resources over such a long period. You know, the miscalculation at the beginning of this conflict was absolutely breathtaking. I think we're seeing it again now. I think this idea that now we think about troops into the country, is it that these Western elites have got together and they've kidded themselves that if we do this next stunt, if we actually go that far, could that be then the catalyst which jumpstarts a new series of diplomacy from Russia or from China? That could well possibly be part of it. The other thing about backing out, which George mentioned, is that there is a timeline to this. And the timeline is 2024 US elections. Now, that can be a point where the West can back out, because if America says, if Biden says 2 months before polls that, okay, we're going to pull out of Ukraine and I'm going to spend $120 billion now on poverty, which I think is what Trump or a Trump-like character will probably do. That will be the stunt they'll pull. You know, at a certain point, you know, everything's off. All bets are off. So I think that these are certain factors that we have to look at. But, you know, there's so much risk. There's so much experimentation. You know, don't bring Liz Truss into it, for God's sake, please. You know, I think there's enough Muppets already sitting around the teak table trying to work out their future careers and the next moves. You know, the time is on the side.
That says it all, Martin. This is all about careers, you know. I mean, exactly. They're trying to figure out who's going to be the next head of NATO. Yeah. Maybe it'll be from the UK. No, it'll, we need a woman from Scandinavia. It's a, what does this have to do with security? I keep asking that. Unfortunately, gentlemen, this is not a podcast. This is a program, and we've run out of time. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and in Marrakesh. I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.